We are beginning this new series, as we mentioned, the next 6 weeks, called The Gift of Hard Things, that within them sometimes we can find grace in unexpected places. And how many of you know, recognize the name Stephen Colbert? Most of you know, apparently, who he is. He's a comedian. He's presently the host of a late-night talk show, the Late Show on network television. Some of you also know he spent some time in Evanston. He's a 1986 graduate of Northwestern University, and then he went on from there and he was a part of the Second City comedy troupe for a while. What a lot of people who know and have heard of his name don't know is that he is the last of 11 children from a devout Catholic family. But when he was 10 years old, his two next brothers closest to him and his father were tragically killed in a plane crash. Later, he had an attempted surgical procedure that failed and left him permanently deaf in his right ear. It's amazing how well he sings with one good ear. So after his brothers and father died, he spent his preteen and his adolescent years as the last child at home with a mother being raised under difficult circumstances, a single mom, sharing with her both their grief, but as well her deep faith. And on occasion, when he's not making jokes, I've heard him talk about this experience of growing up with his mom after the deaths in his family. And one statement stands out particularly strong, is very revealing and intriguing. It simply was this comment. Colbert said, "I love the thing that I most wish had not happened." Hard things that happened, but he found grace, so he was able to say, "I love the thing that I most wish had not happened." This series is inspired by a new book by Mike Iaconelli of the same title, The Gift of Hard Things. We are basing, and our series is inspired by Mike's book. We're not teaching Mike's book, but there's some inspiration that gave us some of the ideas that we're going to be dealing with next 6 weeks. But in the introduction to his book, Mike makes a couple very worthwhile comments. He says, "It's not that we should look for suffering, but if it should find us, there is a truth that life's hardships, if we're able to accept them, often contain unexpected gifts." He goes on, "Failure, disappointment, loss, and other difficult experiences call us to accept our humanity, to feel grateful for what has been given, to receive the care of others, and to seek guidance from the Holy Spirit." And finally, he comments, "The more I accept difficulty as a natural part of the spiritual life, the more I find myself available to the deep gifts of the Holy Spirit, like compassion, trust, gratitude, humility, wonder, and joy." One of those difficult or hard things that I want to begin today with is something that is universal, and something every one of us can say, "Yes, I know exactly what that's like." And the hard thing is to be around difficult people. So today we're going to talk about the gift of difficult people. I know each one of you, I don't have to ask how many difficult people there are in your lives right now. It could be a relative. Frequently, the difficult people live with us. Could be a parent. Could be a sibling. Could be your spouse or one of your in-laws. Could be your boss, your employer. Could be someone you work with. Could be one of your children. Could be your ex-spouse or ex-partner. Sometimes they still have big influence in our lives as well that creates difficulty. It could be somebody that's in your Vineyard small group. Yes, it could be the person sitting next to you this morning is the difficult person for you that you're trying to navigate and figure out how to live with this person and make peace here. I don't know how many of you may work in customer service. Customer service, by its nature, is answering the phone with somebody on the other side who is not in happy with something that you sold them. And you're dealing frequently with a difficult person. Today, I would say, and I know the training is increasing, if you need to know how to deal with difficult people if you're going to be a flight attendant. Right? Or if you're in law enforcement. When you encounter people in law enforcement, they are often not thrilled to encounter with you. They have negative expectations, and you might be writing them a ticket or giving them some instruction or whatever. But our law enforcement people need lots of training in dealing with difficult people. Would you not agree? Or maybe you're one of the travelers in our church, perhaps a business person. You're a road warrior. You're traveling all the time and staying in different hotels, flying through airports. You've gone through security. You've been searched up, down, what you know, every which way. You've taken your shoes off so many times. You've lost your belts in other airports, and you know what it's like to encounter difficult people or to occasionally become one, because we are surrounded by a host of difficult people, and frequently we may be one ourselves, right? So today we're going to focus on one chapter of the Bible, amazing story that I've never heard preached on a sermon before. I have never preached myself before, and I can't believe I've never encountered that. This is not something you'll find in the Akinelli's book about the gift of hard things, but I think, as I was asking my wife when we were talking about who do we think know in the Bible that really had an incredible issue with a difficult person or difficult people and was able to successfully manage that. And we came up with this amazing story you'll find in the Old Testament, in the historical books of the Old Testament, the book of 1 Samuel. We're going to deal with one of those rare times we deal with almost a whole chapter. Chapter 25 of 1 Samuel. And we have an opportunity for you to take hope and instruction from one of the most remarkable women who ever lived 3,000 years ago. A true biblical heroine. We're given that her name is Abigail. Anybody hear name Abigail or have an Abigail in your family or know any Abigails? Yeah, there's some Abigails among us. You may know this already, but if not, after today's message, I want you to note that we today are going to present to you the namesake from which all Abigails are connected throughout history. 3,000 years ago, the ultimate Abigail, the great heroine of chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, whose compelling story offers us a model of wise and godly behavior for both women and men in every century. Her initial major challenge is that she was married to a fool. She's not the first one to be married to a fool, and she won't be the last. But her husband was so subject to foolish behavior that he was given a nickname, and in fact, his nickname stuck with him, that his real name has been lost to history. All we know is his nickname, the Hebrew name Nabal, which means the fool. And so, isn't that great? I'm married to the fool. You know, well, and that is exactly what all the neighbors called him, for good reason. He was the ultimate self-destructive relative who made the whole family miserable and actually put them in danger. Now, with that description, I know there are dozens of you who could say, oh, there's one of those in my family. A self-destructive person in my family who's actually putting others at risk by their behaviors. And I have people in my family want to know how we deal with a self-destructive fool in our family. But that's not the only difficult person in her life, as we see as this story unfolds. She also has another difficult person of even greater proportions. This man turned out to be one of the most powerful men in the whole region. This is a man who commanded large armies and was very fearsome and fearful and was threatening, and you do not want to be on his bad side. And Abigail found herself on the bad side of a man who had lots of power. Have you ever been in a relationship of unequal power, where somebody with more power had more power than you, and they were being difficult with you, and you are trying to navigate and figure out how am I going to deal with this person who has all this power and seems to be intent upon doing wrong to me or doing harm to me. If you can identify with that at all, you really want to pay attention to how Abigail successfully dealt with this man of power. So we find her story in chapter 25, 1 Samuel. We're going to take our time going through it because, as I said, it's virtually the whole chapter. We're going to start in verse 2. We are going to skip the first verse. Okay. Starting with verse 2. There was a certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel who was very wealthy. Her husband was a rich fool. He had great wealth. They were aristocratic landed gentry. They had money and influence and possessions and wealth. The land they talk about there, Maon and Carmel, are not some of the more famous cities of that name in the Old Testament, but locations near Jerusalem and in Judah in the southern Israel. And says, talking about his wealth, he had 1,000 goats, 3,000 sheep. That's how you measured your money in those days. And it was the time for the shearing in Carmel, where they would get all the wool from the sheep. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and she was an intelligent and beautiful woman. But her husband was surly and mean in his dealings, and he was a Calebite, and that must not be a good thing if it means the way he turned out. Now, at the same time, and here we get the historical setting for this, it is during the time when David, who had been anointed by Samuel to be king, was not yet king. Because it says he was in the wilderness. And if you recall, he was driven into the wilderness by the existing king Saul, who was threatened by David, who wasn't thrilled that David had been anointed to be king. And he was chasing after David. And David and his mighty men and his soldiers were hiding in the wilderness, trying to live off the land and avoid Saul's army. So this is the historical setting of the interaction between Nabal's family and David. David's in the wilderness. And David heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. It was a time of making some money, shearing the sheep, going to be able to sell the wool. So it's a celebratory time. So he went and he sent 10 men. And he said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. And say to him, 'Oh, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours.'" So he's commissioned them to bring a blessing and some positive words from powerful David to rich Nabal. And now David says, "I hear that it is sheep shearing time. So tell him this: when that your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, excuse me. And the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing." Now that's pretty good. You've got a whole army living off the land, and they haven't stolen anything. None of his sheep was missing. They have, in fact, provided protection for Nabal's shepherds. And they have taken nothing of his. That was the message that David sent. So then tell him to ask your servants, and they will tell you. "So therefore, be favorable towards my men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David," and David is using a very self-deprecating term. He's saying, "Your son David." David is being very honoring to him, self-deprecating, calling him Nabal's son. "Please give them whatever you can find for them. You are a wealthy, rich man. Do you have anything you could offer to us for all the protection we've been and how nice we've been to you?" So when David's men arrived, they gave Nabal that message in David's name. Then they waited for the answer. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Well, there's many servants breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? I don't know anything about David's people. Maybe they're runaway slaves and servants. You know, I just have no respect for them at all." The ultimate statement of disregard. "And why should I share, even though I've got a lot, why should I share it with these people? Who knows where they came from?" This seems to be typical of Nabal's general attitude we see. So David's men did not stay around long. We're not very welcome here. Doesn't sound like we're getting lunch, boys. We better get back home. So they turned, hightail it back. They returned around and went back. And when they arrived, they reported every word. And then David said to his men, "Each of you strap on your sword." So they did. And David strapped on his as well. This is not going to go well. This is David, the warrior. And he's just called on all of his guys to arm up. And so he says, so 400 men went up with David, and they left 200 to stay with the supplies. So two-thirds of his army he is taking, headed towards Nabal's household. But there was a servant there. And one of the servants there went and told Abigail, Nabal's wife. He says, David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings. But he hurled insults at them. And yet these men were very good to us, speaking of David's men. They did not mistreat us, and yet the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. They didn't take anything from us. And night and day, in fact, they were a wall around us the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do. The servant's definitely agitated here. Because, notice the next word, disaster. Disaster is hanging over our master, not just over our master, but over his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. We can't get through to Nabal. He is so stubborn and wicked. He is putting the whole family at risk there. And we got 400 soldiers coming our way that are strapped. Abigail didn't panic. She didn't melt into confusion. Rather, she acted quickly. And she took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on the donkeys. And then she told her servants, "You go on ahead. I'll follow you. Let me send you first with all this offering, with all these gifts. And I'll come later." And then, very interestingly, we'll pick this up in a minute if we study your character, she seems to be very aware of the issues of dealing with her foolish husband, because she says she did not tell her husband Nabal. I'm not saying that this is a manual for all marriage relationships, but apparently there are some times when not reporting things immediately may be advantageous. We'll do a marriage seminar some other time. But at least when you've got a fool for a husband like Nabal, you may not keep him up to date exactly all the time. We'll leave it there. Marriage counseling comes later. Okay. So as she came riding her donkey, coming down the mountain ravine, there was David and his men descending on the other side of the ravine toward her, and she met them. And David had just said to himself, you know, "It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow Nabal's property in the wilderness, and nothing that was missing, and he's paid me back what? Evil for good." And then he calls down an oath, like a curse on himself. I mean, he used the strongest possible language. "May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him, Nabal." Woo! Things have gotten very serious here. Nabal's miserliness and insult towards David has now put his whole family at risk. And David has called down an oath that God do punish David if I don't kill them all. Man, it's going to take a miracle here. It's going to take some serious negotiations. It's going to take some great wisdom. It's going to take some dealing miraculously with some very difficult people, right? And that's exactly what happened. That's why I so love this chapter. David had just said that to himself. By morning, they're dead. And then, says Abigail, she saw David. And she quickly got off her donkey, and she bowed down before David. And she actually put her face all the way to the ground. And she fell at his feet, and she said, "Oh, pardon your servant, my Lord." That's herself. "And let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Please pay no attention, my Lord, to that wicked man Nabal. Please disregard him. He is just like his name." His name means fool. "And folly goes with him." And I'm sure she should say, "And I could tell you a lot of stories." But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men that my Lord sent. I didn't see your group coming asking for some food. I wish I'd seen it. Oh, no. And now, my Lord, as surely as the Lord your God lives and as you live, since the Lord has kept you from bloodshed up to this point and from avenging yourself with your own hands, may your enemies and all who are intent on harming my Lord be like Nabal. And let this gift which I brought to you, which your servant has brought to you, my Lord, may it be given to the men who follow you. So she is trying to make up for her husband's great failure. And then she says, Lord, please forgive your servant's presumption. She is so humble in her approach to him. And then, not just does she come up with this whole plan of how to appease and make things right with David, she is given a prophetic understanding of him. Because listen, she says, the Lord your God will certainly make you a lasting dynasty. Make a lasting dynasty for my Lord. Because you fight the Lord's battles, and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. She sees that he will succeed over Saul. She prophesies to this man who has beleaguered and been chased around the desert and the wilderness, and she says, you're going to win. The Lord has shown me that you will be given the kingdom. The dynasty, a lasting dynasty, will be given to you. And now, even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, Saul, the life of my Lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. She's saying, you're going to turn out okay, David. She brings him encouragement and a prophetic word of his destiny, saying, God's going to protect you. And so she's in the midst of trying to protect her family, and she's giving this great and prophetic blessing of David. And she says, now, but the lives of your enemies, he's going to hurl away like the pocket of a sling. He says, you don't need to worry about Saul and your enemies. God's going to deal with them. Because when the Lord has fulfilled for my Lord every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him ruler over Israel, my Lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or having avenged himself. So he's saying, I'm here to save you from having bloodshed on your hands. Because one day you're going to be the king. You're going to be the ruler. And you're going to want to be a ruler with clean hands. You're not going to want to have my family's blood on your hands. I'm here to appeal to you for your future destiny to change the oath that you've just made. And when you have been elevated as ruler over Israel, when the Lord your God has brought about my Lord's success, remember your servant, me, she says. Now we have this moment of tension. We have the 400 soldiers gathered, clad, ready for battle. We got David worked up into a lather here. He's called down an oath. He's ready to go out and kill them all. And then she has come and humbled herself before him with this alternative plan. Accept this food and all these other things. And don't put blood on your hands. And please ignore my husband. And just hear me out here. Because so much is in the balance. And so the dramatic answer of David is this. David said to Abigail, praise be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. David, he said, oh, this is a good thing. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Because otherwise, as surely as the Lord of God of Israel lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been kept alive by daybreak. Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, go home in peace. I've heard your words. I've granted your request. What a story. Should make a movie about this. I know they've already made two or three historical novels, but that's a story. She comes and her appeal and the way she responded turned the tide. But that's not the end of the story. There's two postscripts to the story that you want to hear, I'm telling you. Because she went back home to Nabal. And he was in his house holding a banquet like that of a king. And as usual, he was in high spirits and very drunk. So she had told him nothing at all till daybreak. Oh, she's been through this a few times. No sense trying to reason him when he's drunk. Well, let's wait till tomorrow morning. But in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. I don't know what kind of a medical description that is. But it's not good. And 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. And then when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Oh, praise be the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. I didn't do anything. No blood is on my hands. Nabal was contemptuous to me, and the Lord's dealt with him. He has kept his servant from doing wrong, and he has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head." That's postscript number one. God, the Lord, deals with Nabal. Both Abigail and David put it in the Lord's hands instead of David having blood on his hands. That's a great end of the story, but that's not the end of the story yet. Postscript number two. So then David sent word to Abigail. This is a smart lady. This is a fine woman. She's got my attention. I think maybe she'd be a fine queen someday. He asked her to become his wife. So his servants went to Carmel and asked, said to Abigail, "Well, David has sent us to you to take you to become his wife." And she bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "I am your servant. I'm ready to serve you and wash the feet of my Lord's servants." She Abigail quickly got on a donkey and, attended by her five female servants, went with David's messengers and became his wife. Now, she had to give up all the wealth and the, because, you know, David's running around the desert still in the wilderness. It's not less like fine living right now. But one day, when God exalts David and puts him on the throne, she's going to be David's wife and queen. Now, that's the sequel to the Abigail story. That makes another movie right there. That's what they do in sequels these days. Okay. Quickly, I want to show you there are six principles, six character qualities that I've identified here in Abigail. If anybody here has any difficult relationships, don't raise your hand. But if you happen to have any, you might want to pay attention to the six qualities she has. And as I read them, and as they're in your notes, you say, you know, this one I'm a little short on. Maybe I put a little star there. I'd like to have more of that character quality, because that certainly did well by Abigail. That brought her through. I like these qualities. Lord, give me more of this one or that one or that one. So if you want to take notes, the first quality that she said and displayed was dependency. When the word comes that her husband brought destruction on her and that David's coming, she doesn't fade away. She showed a great dependence on God. She was looking to the one who was dependable. She depended upon her dependable God. Just like in this picture we see of this man walking on the water, depending on a dependable God. Peter walked on the water. He depended on his dependable God. Abigail was depending on God to come up with a solution. This looks like a disaster before us here, but God's not done. He has promised to be the dependable one. And she looked at him, and in a moment, he gave her this revelation of how to deal with the situation, and he gave her spiritual insights as well into David. It all came together because she was relying on our dependable God. He gave her a way of escape from her predicament. She trusted and leaned into him, and he guided her out of this disaster. She didn't dissolve into panic or anger. She just trusted God, and he gave her an inspired solution to this mess. Let me invite you to do the same. You're dealing with a difficult person, turn to your dependable God. What avenues do you have for me here, Lord, that can be? I need another option than the first option that is before us. Reveal it to me, because I know I can depend upon you. The second quality that we see in Abigail here, today we call it empathy. Understanding and sharing the feelings of another person. Who did she have empathy for in this story? For David. She had sympathy for all of her family. She's feeling with that. But with David, she was identifying, oh, I can't believe that David's the insult. This man that God has appointed, that God has raised up, and how badly my husband's treated him. She got herself inside of David's head and could understand what was going on, and then could formulate a plan that could deal with the fact of why David could be reasonably so offended. She demonstrated empathy, which is basically just sharing the feelings of others. I'm fortunate right now, my wife and I, we have three toddler grandchildren of our grandchildren. And they show, even at that young age, empathy for one. If one of them is crying, the others get concerned. I was with them just last week, you know, and you can see here, there's one, you know, something's gone wrong with his day. He's crying, and the other one, he says, "I may not know a lot, but I know what tears are. And I know what it's like to feel sad. And all I can say is, I'm there for you, brother. I'm there with you. I don't know much, but I know about crying. Last weekend, I was holding my 10-month-old grandson. And we went outside, and the wind picked up and caught my eyes and started to tear. It was just, you know, not an emotional thing, but he didn't know that. And all of a sudden, he looks up at me. He sees a tear come down. He just reached a little hand up, and he's just trying to wipe away the tears on my cheek. And I'm saying, he knows one thing. Crying means somebody's sad. And Papa's sad, and I'm going to put my hand on Papa's cheek. That's what empathy is. It's understanding the feelings another person's going through and identifying with them. And that's what she did. She was horrified at how her husband had treated David and how mean and stingy he was. And she showed empathy. I'll just one quick empathy story, though. You know, every week it seems we get another viral story of one of the 1,000 indignities of being a part of the flying public this week. And the story that this week from San Francisco of a mother and her two babies trying to get on a plane and eventually get to South America, and there was some rude behavior from a flight attendant who's now on administrative leave, and how he treated this woman. Well, the airlines are learning a little bit, because it didn't take but about 3 hours for the CEO of this airline to get on a press release and saying, this is totally unacceptable, because in our view, customer service requires two things, empathy and patience, and that wasn't happening here. I said, he's reading right out of my sermon. If we're going to deal with difficult people, in difficult situations, we have to have empathy, and we'll see in a minute, we have to have the ability to show patience or impulse control. We'll come back to that. We're moving quickly to the third obvious quality of Abigail there, generosity. She was just so generous. She loaded up, find everything, dig up every cake we got, every date, every whatever. We're taking it. We're giving it away. We're going to bless David's men who've protected us. They have done right by us. We're going to try and stop this by being more generous. And she also was generous towards David. She was generous, and she wanted him to experience God's favor. She blessed him and prayed for him. There's a generosity of spirit that's deep in her character. Do you see it there? It's instantaneous, her response to be generous. Despite being married to a miserly fool, she maintained her godly character, especially incredible generosity. I said, this is such a great story. I'm sure one of the grand masters has painted this story. And sure enough, Peter Paul Rubens, in 1630, painted this story. You can find it at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. Now, as everything with Rubens, the story took place 2,600 years before him, but he managed to put everybody in the clothing of his day. But you see Abigail before David making her appeal with all the generosity of the people behind her and what they're bringing. And how you can see in this picture, if you can see it in detail, the response of David's heart. She didn't want David to be robbed of his destiny. She didn't want him to experience disastrous consequences by taking vengeance in his hands. Simply said, generosity is always the right choice. It puts us and others in a place of receiving God's pleasure because it reflects God's character. The other qualities there, spiritual perceptivity. She is there, and she's reading, and God is showing to her David's destiny, and he speaks it prophetically to him, as I showed you before. For you and I, when we're dealing with somebody who's difficult, we need to pray and say, God, show me what's going on inside this person. What are you trying to do there? What are your purposes in their life? How can I pray that your purposes are fulfilled in this difficult person? They're really a pain in the neck to me right now, but I don't think that you've written them off. I believe you have purposes for that person. Show me what they are, that I might imagine and pray for them and what you might want to do with their lives. She was an example of spiritual perceptivity. And the last two things that she demonstrated, one that's obvious, I think I put a star behind this, was immediately her response was one of humility. I have another picture of her kneeling before David. Now, before she ever kneeled before David, do you know we saw that this is already in her character? Do you know who else she was humble with? She was humbled with her servants, because when they brought her the news, she was approachable. She was the wealthy grand lady of the place, but she was approachable and humble and listened to her lowly servants who said, I think we're in trouble here. She didn't write him off. And that humble attitude toward her servants is transferred right over to when she meets David. And her humility towards him as well as her generosity turned his heart. She was willing to humbly kneel and listen to them. I mean, lastly, the last quality that she demonstrated, which I would call it today is the new language would be impulse control. She knew how to wait and be patient for the right timing. She comes back after David relents and calls off the army, and she sees her husband, and she sees him drunk at the festival. He says, not good timing. I'm going to hit the pause. I'm going to hit the impulse control button. My impulse is to tell him this, but I'm going to wait. She demonstrates great self-control of timing on things. And so her impulse control is something that you and I desperately need when you're dealing with difficult people. Every flight attendant in America needs impulse control, right? Not to immediately react. And as a flight attendant, I'm sure at least 98% of us need it, maybe 100%, to be able to hit the impulse. She was patient and deliberate in choosing the timing of when to tell her husband what she had done. Every encounter you and I have with other people carries the possibility of changing how we experience the world. This woman, Abigail, begins chapter 5 struggling in a miserable marriage to a fool. And she ends the chapter as the wife of the future king, receiving the lavish favor of the Lord on her. What a story. I can see why God gave us a whole chapter about Abigail. She's a hero. May God give us Abigail's grace to deal with our difficult people and the grace to face our own disappointments and our losses and griefs. We finish with just one final story. There was a group of people who were out west at a guided spiritual retreat where they're being led through exercises where you meditate and everybody's quiet and it's kind of a little bit like some of our Good Friday services, and you're supposed to think and meditate and then write something down or respond to God. So it's a very quiet thing. So there was a retreat just a few years ago, and there was a husband and wife that were in attendance at the retreat. And every time there was a guided meditation time, the woman would jump up in front of everybody and start twirling around and dancing and smiling and laughing. And the people trying to get a serious retreat out were totally distracted. They were really fed up with their, later they actually said that when they were getting, they were talking about that last session, and then they said, who is that idiot? He really got him. I'm here to have this quiet time with God, and this person is messing with the disturbing this. And what was even more strange was then they went into a time of total silence where nobody's supposed to be talking. Except that when they were trying to be quiet and they were silently praying, her husband started making noises. He started laughing, couldn't hold back his laughter. He was chuckling and laughing. And everybody's giving him the eye. This is supposed to be a serious spiritual time, and you are, what are you thinking about? So they came under a lot of judgment of the other people there. One retreatant even said that, I got so fed up by the end of the retreat, I wanted to go over and choke that guy. I want to put my hand around his head and say, okay, Chuckles, let's hear you laugh now. You can see how spiritual people get at these things. Even in spiritual places, you can get annoyed, can't you? Annoyed with other people and how they're behaving. Well, the end of the story, which is a real revelation, was this. Wasn't learned until a few months later, one of the retreatants found out that that couple had come on the retreat because that year they had lost a son who had died. And they had gone on retreat trying to deal with their grief, looking for comfort and relief. And particularly about the time of with the father and his chuckling. So the person, when they found out that why he had been at the retreat, he said, well, tell me, what was going on with all that chuckling? And he says, well, while we were silent, I closed my eyes and I could see my son. And in the presence of God there, I remembered the times when we laughed together. And then I started laughing. And it helps me feel that sometimes and somehow he's okay. Wow. We make all these judgments not knowing what's going on in people. As Brian said during communion today, not walking in their shoes. And here this couple was there to receive refreshment from the Lord, and other people were put out of place by it. Stand with me. You have rescued us, Lord. We thank you that we all have different stories where you've protected us like you did Abigail's family. And I pray right now that as we think over that list of character traits that you would highlight, the ones that you want to deepen us in, that you want to make a difference in, I pray, Lord, that we would grow to become people with greater capacities for difficult people. For God, you know you're going to give us more difficult people in our lives. So we want for more of what it takes to deal with that. More generosity, more humility, more empathy, more dependency. Give that to your people, Lord, that this can be a church that has the capacity to love and absorb difficult people and to deal with us when we are that difficult person. Hear our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you. Gino's talking next week about disappointment. Go out and be the church.